Welcome to the ESIP Global Economy Podcast. My name is Fredrik Eriksson, and today I am talking to Dalibor Rohak. Dalibor has been on this pod before, talking about his latest book in defense of globalism. He's a resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute in Washington, D.C., covering issues such as the European Union, transatlantic relations, political economy, and the developments in Central and Eastern Europe. Recently, he returned to his native Slovakia to run for parliament, but his bid wasn't successful. The party coalition that he ran for, a combination of the centre-right SPOLU and the left-liberal Progressive Slovakia, failed to cross the 7% threshold to take up a seat in parliament. The winner, Igor Matovic from the Ordinary People Party, is now due to take helm and establish a new government in Slovakia. In an essay for The American Interest, Dalibor has written about his failed election bid and how European politics, not just in Central and Eastern Europe, is being reshaped. Europe's center-right is dying, writes Dalibor. And in today's podcast, we will talk about what forces are squeezing establishment and middle ground parties, especially on the right side of that field, and how they are responding. Welcome to the podcast, Dalibor.
Frederick, great to be with you.
So I want to lead off this conversation with a quote from your essay, and it goes like this. As of now, however, it is fair to say that the space between the cosmopolitan and progressive politics of the left, with its excesses, and the vulgar nationalism of the populist right is shrinking. That leaves those who want to preserve and defend globalization and Western alliances without buying wholesale into the left's agenda on economic and cultural issues in an uncomfortable spot. Close quote. So is it just an uncomfortable spot, or are we, in your view, looking at an existential moment for mainstream European liberal conservatism?
So I don't want to overgeneralize my own experience running in this parliamentary election in Slovakia, but I have to start on a somewhat personal note. I mean, for me, it was a truly fascinating experience to sort of move away from the world of analysis and writing and wonkery into the world of campaigning. And I value the experience partly because it has shown me that I'm not very good at campaigning, and maybe I should think twice before making any future attempts at being a career politician. And so I think there's a conversation to be had about what we did right, what we did wrong in the campaign, a sort of post-mortem about our messaging and campaigning. And there's a long list of mistakes I suppose we could go through. But I don't think that's particularly of interest to your listeners. I think what is more of interest is the extent to which our failure might reflect a broader pattern you see elsewhere in Europe. It was quite striking. I was a few weeks before the election, I was in Stockholm, and I spoke to some of my friends from the Moderate Party, some of my friends at Timbro. They just published actually a Swedish edition of my book in defense of globalism. And in retrospect, I'm struck by how their evaluation of the Swedish situation resembled my own assessment after the election of what happened in Slovakia. What I share with my friends from, say, the Moderate Party or from other center-right parties in Central Europe or indeed across Europe is the belief that there is value in sort of moderate, ecumenical, pro-market approach to politics, and yet that approach is not necessarily meeting with the sort of demand it was relying on for many decades after the Second World War. And so you naturally have politicians on the center-right responding to that reality. Some are trying to defeat the far-right populists at their own game. Some are, I suppose, moving further to the center and to the left. But although these days the European People's Party remains the largest group in the European Parliament and the sort of largest political grouping in Europe, I think it's getting weaker by the day. And I don't think anybody right now has a recipe for how to get out of the situation and how to reinvent center-right politics in a new way that would go back to its natural constituency that existed for a long time.
Yeah. No, and I think we can sort of walk through almost country by country and see that development.
Yeah.
France, as you mentioned in your essay, is a very clear example where the center-right party has been shrunk into oblivion almost.
Yeah.
We can go through, look at the Nordics, the Netherlands, Belgium, etc., and we find that we hardly have any center-right in Italy anymore.
Right.
Because we've seen what remained of the center-right after Berlusconi had destroyed it was basically taken over by Salvini. So I think, I mean, one thing I'm wrestling with and trying to understand here is looking at the diagnosis here for the center-right parties. Do we have sort of, or do they face a problem which is about that it's difficult to find a spot of balance at a time when typical culture war polarization happens? So on the one hand, we do have the vulgar nationalists.
Yep.
That campaign or that run or argue sort of on the basis of, if not closing the border, so something which is similar to it, not always totally against migration, but certainly against the notions of sort of a traditional open liberal type of multiculturalism, for want of a better term for it. So we have that on the one hand. On the other hand, we have sort of a wokish, progressive, left liberal development that is also stealing voters from different parties, especially those that are metropolitan and urban-based voters. So is it that is the problem for the center-right party, so that they're basically squeezed from two different angles? Both these sides are stealing their voters. Or are we talking about sort of other forms of shifts that have happened which have made it more difficult for the center-right parties to keep the type of, not dominating, but at least central position that they've had in politics for a long time in Europe?
Well, it's a sort of well-established thesis repeated by many, which I suppose carries a grain of truth in it, that the dividing lines of European and indeed Western politics are changing. That few years or decades ago, we had a debate about the size of government, we had a debate about, you know, marginal tax rates and public debt, and people were animated by those debates, and it just, people are, you know, animated by slightly different questions these days, particularly questions of openness versus parochialism, questions of cultural values. There has been also an erosion of trust in the system, so to speak, as a result of the financial crisis, as a result of, say, the mishandling or the sort of degree to which the EU has been was overwhelmed in 2015 and 16 by the influx of refugees. And therefore, I think party systems across Europe have sort of responded to that new reality. It's a sort of demand-driven phenomenon, to at least the way I look at it, because you really have people who are sort of, you know, demanding different messages from their politicians, and politicians are eager to provide them. So it was very easy for Emmanuel Macron to upend the French party system by creating his political group overnight. Les Républicains have found it very difficult to adjust to that reality. They tried to sort of, you know, play the game against Marine Le Pen, not very successfully, and they still are struggling. I'm not a big expert on Germany. It looks like Germany still has a big center-right by default, but from where I sit, it looks like the center-right is more or less in a state of hibernation, and I don't know how robust it is. I suppose the next election will tell. That said, there are some experiments in how the center-right can adjust to this new reality. I think the most successful story we hear is one of the Austrian People's Party and Sebastian Kurz, who has tried to occupy, maybe partly through his own skill, partly through luck, that sort of delicate balance, that space between the hard right and the political center. Obviously, he was helped by that scandal, that recording that emerged of the former head of the FPÖ plotting with the Russians. So that might play a role in that. But apart from that, I don't see a whole lot of sort of encouraging success stories in that center right space. And Slovakia, in a way, is a case in point. Although we now do have a center right government, but it's a center right government that is composed of political parties that would, you know, in a different era be considered as part of the extreme right. So one of the coalition parties, they call themselves BR Family, Sme Rodina, is last year they campaigned together with Salvini and Le Pen in the European election, not very successfully, but now they are an important part of the newly formed government coalition. So, and how Matovic himself will sort of balance these sort of different demands. On the one hand, he wants to be a sort of reform-minded politician who will restore rule of law in Slovakia and retain Slovakia as part of the integration core of the EU, but he'll have to cater to that constituency further to the right as well. And cultural clashes over things like abortion and gay marriage and so forth are playing a big role in that as well, which I mean has been true for a while now, but again, I don't see what we could call the normal center-right adjusting particularly well to these new front lines that have emerged in European politics.
I mean, one interpretation is to slightly sort of going against what you were just saying, sort of is that at least in many of the Western European countries, you can make the argument that it's not the voters that have changed, it's the parties that have changed, that voters tend to believe in the same thing today as they believed in 10 years ago or 20 years ago. And as a consequence of that, and as a consequence of a pretty rapid rise for some of the extreme parties, they are now trying to adjust their policies in order to make them more palatable to a center-right opinion that a traditional center-right party now has difficulty commanding. So if we think about sort of classical issues that many of the extreme right parties were putting emphasis on in the past, like issues like you mentioned abortion, sexual education, gender balance, now we are broadly seeing a European nationalist conservative right that is trying to occupy that space with a pretty liberal type of position, being in favor of gender balance, even, you know, gender quotas for corporate boards. They are playing down anything that suggests that they are taking sort of a very Catholic type of view on sexual education, or at least an orthodox Catholic view on sexual education. So that interpretation would basically suggest that, well, it isn't voters that have changed, it's something which has happened with the center-right parties that make them less capable of commanding the type of voters they had in the past. What do you say about that?
I think that's an interesting sort of research question, to what extent this is a sort of demand or supply-driven phenomenon. I think it's fair to say from, you know, what we know about voters' behavior that people don't necessarily make their decisions about whom to vote for on the basis of detailed policy platforms, right? Like people don't come into public life and into like decisions in the polls with fixed preferences over policy and sort of preconceptions about what the government should deliver, and then find the party that's closest to their set of preferences, right? That's sort of the idea of a sort of rational voter that knows what his or her interests are and where different parties are, and then finds the party that's closest to them. I don't think that's happening in the real world. We saw that in the United States in terms of how malleable, you know, the Republicans' attitudes or Democrats' attitudes toward things like free trade or Russia have been over the past couple of years. However, where I think voters might be in the driving seat of all this is at some sort of more basic level, where people do make their decisions based on messages and sort of forms of political campaigning that resonate with them at some deeper emotional level. And with all these crises that Europe has been through and with the crisis we are undergoing today with COVID-19, it looks like pushing the sort of buttons of fear and inviting people into a sort of defensive crouch and promising to sort of protect them against the dangers of the outside world is something that is gaining resonance, together with a sort of promise, whether it's empty or not, of a return to a sort of simpler, more comfortable, easier to navigate past. And I think that's what's been sort of reshaping the world of politics. So it's not so much that like people's preferences and attitudes and what they think about trade have changed, and therefore they are adjusting their voting patterns, but people might be sort of, you know, attuned emotionally and psychologically towards slightly different kinds of political messages than they were in the past, and parties and leaders are responding to that.
I think that is true, and I think it also tails with what you were saying about Sebastian Kurz and what's been going on in Austria. I mean, if we look at the Austrian situation and we try to distinguish the one unique factor which is associated with Sebastian Kurz, it certainly isn't that his party is, you know, an upstart entrepreneurial party, because this is really one of the dominating parties which has been in power for a very, very long time. But it's just that he is different, and that he is taking sort of a different attitude. He speaks more freely. He is perhaps not as self-censorious as other party leaders would be on topics that are controversial, including, of course, migration issues. The other, if we can call it that, center-right leader who has done something similar is Boris Johnson. Also novel, despite the fact that his party has been in government for a long time and is responsible sort of for a big political shambles in the country with Brexit. But he's different, he's new, he's something that distinguish was a new sort of political brand that have the effect of, you know, not being associated with many of the disadvantages and bad reputations that are associated with the traditional parties. So that perhaps is a good indication as anyone else that parties that become a little bit more entrepreneurial in terms of the representation may have a good future, and that the problem with the center-right parties right now, why they are losing the election in many countries, or that they can't return to power, is because they are too much associated with an old establishment that people wanted to kick out. So what I'm getting at here is I think it's an issue of temperament, that voters now value and almost give sort of a premium to any type of leader that can communicate being angry or capture a type of temperament that we wasn't so used to. Political leaders capturing that in the past.
I think that's basically my assessment as well, and it's something that really struck me while campaigning in Slovakia. If I may go back to that experience, really there is a sea of difference between the job of a political scientist or a commentator or an analyst and the reality of politics. You know, finding out things that work and pushing the right sort of buttons at the right time, getting on these sort of emotional waves that are going through the population is something that to my mind is just almost completely disconnected from social science. So I think, yes, many of these things boil down to questions of temperament, boil down to questions of leadership. And it's also something that strikes me can't really be learned or thought or trained. Like, we can't really come up with, like, you know, here is the best list of, like, you know, best practices for the center right on how to win elections again. Like, it's something that it has to come naturally to people. By the way, both Kurz and Boris Johnson are like experiments that are in the making. Like, we I don't think we have enough data to sort of evaluate the success or failure of those experiments yet. But they, I mean, suggest that really what this boils down to is not so much changes to policy and platforms and, oh, let's tweak this policy or that policy, or, you know, let's do something about immigration. But it's primarily about style and leadership style.
Yeah, no, I think that's correct. I think we can sort of explain the outcome of several elections, at least to an extent, with that particular factor of temperament. There is another thing which I also wanted to get into and see what you say, and it relates to the ability of the center-right parties to also change themselves, not just in temperament and style, but also in policies that we know are becoming more important just because realities are changing. So, for instance, what we find in many countries today is a new type of situation of perhaps not social despair, but at least social problems. Just to take a couple of examples, we have the rates of mental illnesses among young people is going up. We have problems with many kids growing up in one-parent household. And, I mean, in many countries, I mean, these problems are getting pretty big. And then you have sort of, on the one hand, a traditionalist response to this development. And you can see this response coming both from nationalist wing of, or the more traditionalist wing of the extreme right, which is, you know, almost a policy of nostalgia where they want to turn back the clock and go back to family situations where we had women wasn't at work, they were at home catering for the kids and cooking food, where urbanization hasn't grown so rapidly. So there is this appreciation for a lifestyle which is far more rural than the one we have today. But you can also see that in our traditional center-right parties that think that this is the response that is correct now to give to the problems that we're seeing. So we have, you know, the Christian Social Union, for instance, in Bavaria, very strong on that message. We see it growing among what remains of the center-right party in France, Les Républicains. We see in Spain that some of the Partido Popular are trying to chase Vox and sort of compete with them on the ground, sort of of trying to reconstitute Spanish society to resemble more the type of society they had 30, 40 years ago before societal modernization has kicked in for real. But none of these messages really hit home, and they aren't very intelligent either. But on the other hand, people are not finding any intelligent responses from the center-left either, or perhaps from parties which are more associated with what you can call sort of a left-liberal progressive approach to policies, but they're not center-left. So I think what I'm getting at here is that it's not just that we have a problem with the center-right, which is that style, presentation, and leadership is a problem for them. It's also that they have neglected their own policy development, and the type of policies they have right now to big things that are happening in societies aren't what people are asking for.
I think there is a difference, though, between the center-left and the center-right, which I suppose boils down to a certain extent to the question of sort of cultural and also political polarization that we are seeing as a result of more and more of our political conversations happening on social media, and also because of, I suppose, the changing sort of cultural patterns you see between cities and the countryside across the Western world. So the center-left, I think, does have a constituency, right? The sort of like cosmopolitan, urban, educated, socially, culturally liberal elite. I mean, it exists. It's going to be there. It's fairly cohesive. The job for the center-right is more complicated, right? It's sort of build a broader coalition that would sort of span from you know, the sort of right-wing fringes of that political left all the way to the sort of left-wing fringes, if you will, if you're sort of talking about the linear spectrum of that sort of more populist right. And it looks like that space that the sort of center-right should want to occupy is getting tighter, precisely because of that sort of self-selection and sorting that people are going through, both geographically and patterns in which they consume news and so forth, that people are sort of selecting into these tribes, and these sort of cultural identities in a way are hardening. And so that's where it sort of leaves the center-right in an uncomfortable spot, because center-right is by its nature sort of, you know, ecumenical and heterogeneous and a sort of big tent alliance of somewhat different constituencies. So that's, I think, to my mind, a sort of phenomenon that's quite independent from this question of like whether we have anything to offer in terms of policies that's relevant, that it speaks to the problems that people are living through and suffering from. And yes, I think there is a conversation to be had about that, that as you have the opioid epidemic in the United States, as you have people displaced by automation and so forth, people who, for one reason or another, feel alienated from elite culture emanating from cities, but you don't really have the center-right speaking to those people very effectively. And that's a problem we've been struggling with for a long time.
So just a quick question. So the center-right in Slovakia, has it traditionally been a rural or a metropolitan voter category, or a mix between them perhaps?
I would argue that it was always a mix between them. I mean, these categories are always a bit tricky. Like Slovakia, since 1989, never really had a sort of settled party system the way all the European countries had. Slovakia had was always a sort of big catch-all sort of populist party that would be somewhat nationalistic and also heavy-handed the government approach in terms of domestic policy, which I suppose you could call that political left. And political right would notoriously be fragmented, would include Christian Democrats, sort of libertarian-ish minded people, and also the sort of traditional left liberals from cities. So that's what the Slovaks would refer to as the political right, which is sort of funny because it does include fragments of the, you know, intellectually minded political left. And so, there was this sort of tension in this coalition we built with Progressive Slovakia, which they're nice people, but they are from the center left. And us from Spolu would try to be this sort of ecumenical center-right moderate party. So there would be sort of disagreements on specific policies and so forth. But after our failure in the election, my suspicion is that Progressive Slovakia has much more of a future ahead of itself than honestly my own party does, or at least the trajectory is far clearer, that there is this sort of space and this constituency that they can cater to, and it's always going to be a niche constituency, but for the center right it leaves us in this sort of odd space where there doesn't look like there are that many voters at the moment, partly because we are, I suppose, competing against a variety of other sort of center-right groups. So in Slovakia, it does cut across these sort of urban-rural divides, but there's also a lot of churn. And the Slovak situation was specific ahead of the election because of the events of the past 2 years, where you had this journalist murdered and his fiancée, and lots of people, regardless of their political affiliations, stood up and decided to say no to that. There were these mass protests and so forth. So there was a huge demand for change and for getting rid of the sort of big government nationalist smear that was running the country for 10 years. But there was extreme degree of volatility among voters of these opposition parties. And maybe it was an accident of history that the election turned the way it did. But there are lots of people who were deciding in the last few weeks ahead of the election, really, or maybe even day of the election. So there was a big demand for change, but not a lot of clarity about what that change should entail, what it should look like.
So Dalibor, you are based at one of the leading center-right think tanks in America, but there has been changes throughout the think tank world in America as well, among sort of free market, center-right, libertarian type of think tanks. When I look at Europe, I see very little happening in terms of the intellectual quality of the center-right conversation. And then we see the nationalist conservatives are trying to make at least an intellectual case for the type of politics that are now growing in the wake of Trump, Orban, and a more traditionalist, nationalist type of parties that we see are gaining in many countries in the opinion polls, if they're not in power already. But at the same time, looking at the type of thoughts and perspectives that come out from these nationalist conservatives, I don't find much of intellectual vibrancy there either. It tends to be some interesting authors and thinkers from time to time that have things to say that you could generally place sort of in a large big tent approach to the center right. Is it different in America? I was going to ask you. Is it more of an intellectual vigor to what has been happening on sort of the nationalist right there?
So you certainly notice the efforts on the nationalist right to come up with some sort of coherent story or set of arguments and policy prescriptions for Trump's presidency, really. This sort of series of conferences organized by Yoram Hazony on so-called national conservatism. And so there is this movement which does have energy behind it and which also co-opted lots of traditional conservatives in America that tries to, I suppose, revise some of the tenets of the 1980s style Reaganite conservatism by saying that maybe we should reassess free trade, that maybe we should reassess America's role in the world. At the same time, it preserves some of these old tenets, like the notion that the administrative state has grown too large and that we have to sort of return to constitutional principles. So it's an ongoing conversation among the nationalists. But I agree that there isn't much of a sort of appealing body of sort of political thought that has come out of it, at least from my perspective. Partly because so much of it is an effort to rationalize and come up with excuses and come up with some sort of coherent stories about what Trump is doing. And at the time when just so much of the Republican Party has been turned into Trump's cult of personality, I think that's dictating a lot of the agenda of the sort of self-styled national conservatives. There are some interesting thinkers on that spectrum who are worth following, of course, but I don't see them as having many answers to the problems that are ailing America or the Western world today. The debate at AEI is slightly different. I think we have always been a broad tent, intellectually speaking. There are, you know, lots of people doing interesting work, maybe looking with critical lenses at, you know, conservative dogmas of the past. There is now a program led by Yuval Levin on social cohesion and culture in America, on how that sort of fraying social fabric could be restored in a way that the United States be a coherent body politic and not be in a state of cold civil war, so to speak. But I think there is a lot of, like, you know, intellectual work to be done before we have good answers. I think one thing that would be helpful would be a resounding defeat for Donald Trump at the polls this November, which I think would lead to a sort of more honest assessment of where we are politically and intellectually as the US center right. And perhaps that would open the window for sort of new, more moderate, yet in many ways bold approach to sort of social and economic problems that are ailing the world. I think the US debate is going to be interesting. I think we know from the past that whatever happens in the US reverberates through the British and through the European political conversations as well. So I think this space is certainly worth watching.
Yeah, no, I certainly agree with you there. And I also think that a resounding defeat for Trump would, you know, lead to a different type of soul searching that it's highly necessary on that front of liberal conservatism in America.
Because right now, so much of it is dominated by the fact that Trump has been perceived as winning, and therefore whatever it is that he is doing and whatever it is that the nationalists are doing is seen as validated by the fact that it sort of worked at the polls. So once that goes away, I think people will have a more honest perspective, even people who are currently on the Trump train and people who are trying to, like, reinvent themselves as national conservatives. I think, you know, people's attitudes, especially of career politicians, are much more malleable than first meets the eye.
Absolutely. A final question, Dalibor. I just want to spend a few moments also talking a little bit about the center-left and what is going on there, picking up what you were saying previously. And I was going to ask if you think there is a difference here between center-left as we perceive it in parts of Central and Eastern Europe, and the center-left in, or a traditional social democracy as we have known it in Western Europe. My take would broadly be that the center-left is largely confronted with the same problems as the center-right. Then we can find differences between countries in terms of which side of the spectrum traditionally occupied power in the past. In many Central and Eastern European countries, for instance, we never had the birth or growth of real classic social democratic parties that became strong electoral forces for reasons, of course, of history and so on. When we look at many of the Western European countries, we have seen a pretty sharp decline in the support for the social democratic powers. Some countries, they have managed to stay afloat, or some, to some extent, also regain in the opinion polls. So we had Mette Frederiksen retaking power, for instance, in Denmark. We had in Spain, where they have sort of clung to power for a longer time than most people expected, for instance. But at the same time, we sort of see still a social democracy which is torn between, on the one hand, its classic blue-collar, non-metropolitan type of voter base, and that's usually where it was strong in the past. And on the other hand, we have the metropolitans, the highly educated people with cosmopolitan views about all sorts of policies. And there is sort of a contradiction between these two groups, and I think we see that also still in many of these social democratic parties. Certainly the case in the Nordics, where social democracy has been very strong in the past, that these are two groups that are increasingly at odds with each other. And social democracy there also finds itself torn between, on the one hand, the nationalists that take the type of blue-collar voters that were traditionally very strongly associated with social democracy, but are now leaving for the extreme right parties because of cultural issues, not always migration issues, but because of cultural issues. And on the other hand, we see green parties, liberal parties that are highly associated with a metropolitan political view that also takes from these parties. So here we have so the same type of contradictions or the same type of problems that center-right parties find themselves in.
So I suppose the difference between Central Europe and Western Europe in this regard is that our starting points are different. That you don't necessarily have in places like Slovakia or Hungary these old established social democratic parties with large traditionally blue-collar electorates that would be going through this crisis of, you know, identity and bleeding voters to the far right. That's what you see elsewhere. What you see in many countries across Central Europe is I suppose the end point of the process that's sort of unfolding in Western Europe. That as a result of these of these realignments that we discussed, that you do have, you know, either highly intellectually minded urban liberal greenish parties catering to that sort of niche electorate of highly educated people in cities, or you have political parties that sort of combine old school, sort of heavy-handed government approach to economic policy with an emphasis on national identity and so forth. Smer that ruled Slovakia for a decade, I think, would be in that latter category. So I think in a way, because we don't have that sort of burden of the past, you know, things have advanced much more, and it shows that there sometimes isn't that much of a difference, or that the sort of barrier between the sort of populist far right and the sort of left, like in the case of Slovakia, Smer, tends to be very, very fuzzy. And that seems to be the space that the sort of Mette Frederiksen is trying to be occupying, but obviously constrained through the legacy of heading a, you know, very respectable and established and an old party. So maybe the choice for central left parties in Europe is really between becoming these sort of, you know, niche political groups for intellectuals in cities you know, the readers of The Guardian all moving in that sort of Danish direction. But the process is still unfolding. And honestly, I don't think we've seen many examples of successful transitions to that sort of Danish path of combining, you know, the traditional agenda of social democracy with, you know, with the emphasis on national identity and immigration restrictions. It's sort of hard to replicate that in the Western European, I think, context, partly because it sort of almost invariably provokes backlashes from the educated urbanites that feel very strongly sort of alienated from that kind of politics.
Yeah, indeed. Finally, I was going to say one question, but I mean two questions. Firstly, why did you decide to run for office in Slovakia? And lastly, are you going to run for it again?
That's a great question. So my initial decision was driven by a number of factors. First of all, I was always involved in some capacity back home in Slovakia. For many years, I had the weekly column in one of Slovakia's newspapers. I like the country. I'm there often. I try to keep a presence there. And I always wanted to be helpful in one way or another. And I felt that after that murder in 2018 of this journalist and his fiance, Slovakia really was at crossroads, that it could either become, you know, the next Moldova almost, and marginalize itself within the European Union and be a sort of mafia-ridden state, or it could go through sort of serious reforms to the judiciary, to the police, and restore rule of law and sort of basic sense of fairness and sort of standards that people, you know, to the west of Slovakia often take for granted. And so to me, this election was not like any other election. It really was one of those like once in a generation opportunities to do something. And I felt that if things had gone in a different direction, maybe the outcome would have been much worse than even the status quo was 2 months ago. So there was a very strong neo-Nazi party, which arrived third or fourth, I think, in the polls, but it's not sort of dominating the landscape the way it was dominating some of the opinion polls a few months ago. And so these are like real unreformed neo-Nazis. So the atmosphere was at the same time an atmosphere of great promise and opportunity, but also of great peril. And I thought it was, you know, my patriotic duty, so to speak, to try to be helpful. So but the basic lesson from the election is that maybe, you know, I and politics don't necessarily mix that well, and I would love to be involved and helpful, you know, even though my party is not in government. Like, I want to be sort of supportive. I think there is going to be, broadly speaking, a change for the better after this election, but I'm not, you know, particularly tempted by the prospect of running in the parliamentary elections again, to be perfectly frank with you.
All right, thank you very much, Dalibor. It's been a great joy talking to you.
Frederick, thank you so much.